from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
And a very good evening to you, wherever you are listening from. And if you are listening to the recorded podcast, a very good day to you for whatever time of day you happen to be listening to us. This should be another fantastic show. Big kudos to Brody Levesque, who has pulled a lot of producing duties and coordinated a lot of our subjects and guests. And so a big upfront shout out to him. Tonight's show should live up to our current crop of well-produced programs. We are going to be talking about different issues going on in the state of Oklahoma. And one primarily big issue is a battle against quote-unquote reparative therapy or quote-unquote conversion therapy. And the biggest quotes of all should be around the word therapy, because all of these programs, regardless of what they call themselves, where they're trying to convince people that their innate, intuitive sexual orientation is not correct and try to quote-unquote correct them back to something else or to something else, is what this is all about. And so far, several states have made this practice illegal to inflict on minors under the age of 18, which is a majority of the people who are forced into these programs are teenagers whose parents are concerned when they come out and want to change them. And the damage to these kids has been insurmountable. And so we're going to talk about that. We're going to a young man who is deeply entrenched in it. Our guest is going to be Troy Stevenson, who is the executive director of Freedom Oklahoma. Troy is nationally recognized civil rights advocate, and he's personally served as the executive director of the Garden State Equality in New Jersey, as well as being a veteran of two presidential campaigns. So he is going to take us through the fight that he is fighting in Oklahoma, not only on the reparative therapy front, but on several other key issues that are of LGBTQ interest happening in the state of Oklahoma. But before we get into that, normally on the show, we have an in-the-news segment put together exclusively for our show by seasoned journalist Brody Levesque. But tonight we want to do something different. I'm going to bring our panelists on, renowned journalist Karen Oakham and the aforementioned renowned journalist Brody Levesque. And instead of our normal news broadcast that we're going to do, we're going to actually pay tribute to a man who passed away this week. And Karen wrote a very profound and wonderful piece about him in the LA Blade. And that man was Stephen Bacho. And Karen, welcome to the show. And can you give us a little overview of your piece?
Well, thank you. And hello, everyone. Well, one of the things that concerned me was that all the outpouring of stories regarding Stephen Bacho's death on April 1st, he died after a long battle with cancer. He was 74. All of them mentioned NYPD Blue and Hill Street Blues and a number of other Doogie Howser MD. Some of you might remember that with introducing the world to Neil Patrick Harris. But none of them mentioned what I thought was a really important characteristic, which is how he covered or introduced gay characters as normal, regular folks in his TV series. And I thought it was, it was very important to take note of that. I actually happened to have had a friend who worked on Hill Street Blues. He was openly gay. He was not open about the fact that he was HIV positive, but this was like in the early 1980s or something, so he wouldn't be. Otherwise, there goes the insurance. But he was very well liked, and he was very well accepted by his fellow actors, and he subsequently died, of course. We didn't have treatments at that time. But it was an indication, just to start with, of Stephen Bochco's kind of like mindset. And I thought that that was very important to note. Then, you know, as I mentioned, Neil Patrick Harris, of course, he was a kid, so he wasn't in any way out. But for those, some of us looking back on it, you know, might go, well, this kid might turn out to be one of us, as he surely did. And then in 1991, on his series L.A. Law, there was a very important kiss. I mean, it might not seem like anything, and it wound up becoming sort of a ratings ploy because there was a tease about it, so everybody tuned in to see it. This was the C.J. Lamb, who was one attorney, played by Amanda Donahoe, kissing fellow lawyer Abby Perkins, played by Michelle Green. And the thing about it was that it was so casual, and it was well received as Amanda leaned in to kiss Abby, Michelle Green, and then they kissed a little bit more passionately, and then it became uncomfortable. But the thing was is that it wasn't abhorrent. I mean, it wasn't disgusting, as, you know, like Roseanne had a kiss on her show at one point, and then afterwards you could see her wiping her mouth. You know, there wasn't anything like that. And this was the first lesbian kiss on television. So for those of us watching it, it was kind of like, wow, did you see that? But people forget, you know, we forget our history. And then, of course, perhaps one of the most important characters was on NYPD Blue, where the PAA, the public assistant, administrative assistant, was not only openly gay, but he was, you saw the evolution of his character from being on the show and having to deal with Andy Sipowicz, who was this racist, homophobic, alcoholic detective Andy Sipowicz, played by Dennis Franz. You watch the evolution of that relationship as kind of like a reality thing, you know, it really reflected reality. And you saw the arc of the evolution to, you know, finally, you know, the character was contributing to the overall thinking in the, even though he was a temp, he was contributing to the way that people were viewing criminals and family members and people who came into the squad room. And then there was this shaking of hands between Andy Sipowicz and, oh, heavens, what was his name? I've forgotten the character's name right now. But anyway, John Irvin is what his name was. And then it went from shaking of the hands to they became more comfortable, and Sipowicz got clean and sober at one point. And then you came to a point where John Irvin was in the locker room with Andy Sipowicz, cutting Andy Sipowicz's hair. I mean, it was like that never would have happened at the beginning of this show. And then the show evolved even more, where Sipowicz wound up having this young kid, and asked the gay PAA, John Irvin, who by this time was his friend, to come and babysit. Now, this was pre-AIDS medications. You had ministers who were saying, you know, AIDS was God's punishment for being homosexual. And yet here without any big fanfare, I think GLAAD may have honored him at one point, but There was no big publicity about it, no big fanfare. There was this arc of a relationship that mirrored reality at a time when, you know, gay people, gay men in particular, were dying, like, a lot, and standing up for themselves. But here was this guy who was just a regular guy who was being himself and was, you know, trying to be polite and of service. And it was an incredible character development. And one other note I'd like to make about Stephen Bochco is that he also had a lot of gay people, openly gay people, behind the camera as well, like Paris Barclay, who was now a very well-known African-American producer and director. But Bochco essentially gave Paris his start at NYPD Blue, and then they went on and created a show together called City of Angels, and he worked on a number of other Bochco shows as well, and Bochco came to Project Angel Food when Paris was recognized. And, you know, things like this, I mean, it was at a time when it was kind of dangerous, if you will, for the entertainment industry to show their support for LGBT civil rights and for gay men and to put gay men, you know, as regular people on television. Stephen Bochco did that, and none of the obits that I read commented on that. And I thought that it was, we really, really, really need to remember our own history. And when we have allies like this, we need to thank them, even if it's, you know, in an obituary. You know, we need to remember our allies and how they fit into our LGBT history, because this is such a critical part of our development of the movement. So that's essentially the be and end all for me.
Yeah, I remember L.A. Law had quite a few plot lines in their cases that were very pro-LGBT through the run of the series. And also one thing, I was mentioning this offline to Brody Levesque, Harry Hamlin had kind of stuck his neck out, he had a very poignant role in the film Making Love, where he played a gay character, and kind of got a little bit typecasted, it seemed, through that. And Stephen Bochco is the one who brought him out, put him on L.A. Law, and kind of recreated him. And sort of fearlessly, not living up to Harry's perceived typecasting.
Sort of regenerated his career, rejuvenated his career after. Yeah, you're right. Harry Hamlin really, because he played the role well as a gay man in Making Love, but people wouldn't hire him after that.
Right.
Right.
I have one question, and you may not know the answer to this, but as I recall, Michelle Green actually did not take to the plot line very well of her character becoming lesbian. And it seems to me that there was a huge pushback. Was that correct, or am I just remembering?
She was uncomfortable. I don't know if, it was her version of a pushback. And I don't know if they were lesbian. Amanda Donahoe would have been more of the lesbian than Amanda Green, but it was, I think Amanda Donahoe was supposed to be sort of more bisexual. And I think that Green, she did have a problem with the, the plot and why it was done. She was the one who said, it was just a ploy, a ratings ploy, which in fact, it did well in boosting the ratings, that's for sure. And then it did become a go-to thing for sweeps, that's for sure, too. But she didn't, what I focused on in my piece was not the backlash so much, because that happened kind of later. And I think she was worried about criticism from, not being a good Christian girl or something like that. But what I focused on is the kiss itself that did make television, wasn't censored, and she played it well. I mean, she had that awkward little moment at the end, but the kiss itself was looked very genuine.
Yeah, no, yeah. Totally. And Brody, you you actually met Stephen, I believe. Do you want to give some reminiscence?
I actually had he was an acquaintance that I had met, and at the time I met him, they were working on L.A. Law, and this was in the early 90s. The one thing that always I thought set Stephen apart from the other power producers was his willingness to be fearless in supporting the, you know, community, the tribe, as it were, with not only the actors and, of course, the people that, you know, are in front of the camera, but very much so the people behind the camera. Stephen actually, I think, in many ways set a tone, and during the time, the contemporaries to him were Aaron Spelling, Don Belisario, and Stephen J. Cannell. And I think that in many ways, what he did probably set the tone for the other three. Those were, you know, the four powerhouses in particularly television at that time. Between the four of them, I think that they had virtually every hit show on every network and cable in a couple places covered. And he was, you know, he was fearless about it. I asked him at one point, and his answer was, you know, about the support and the, you know, basically we use the term ally now, but I think at the point that I asked him was, you know, you're being, you know, affirming of these people and you're not, you know, basically putting them in a box. He said, it's the right thing to do. And that's just really, I think how he always did things. And it was reflected not only in the characters that you saw in his shows, but I think the influences that he played on his co-producers, Belisario, Spelling, and Cannell, but also Hollywood in general. I think that a lot of what Stephen did really laid the groundwork for things to come. And again, this was in a time period, as Karen pointed out, where you wouldn't expect that. So anyway, he will be missed, and it really is a tragedy.
Yeah, well, thank you both for the overview and the insight on that. I know he was a huge influence on me growing up with all that programming, and I do remember as a young gay man, every time that it went to anything LGBT, that was a huge, huge deal, much bigger than it is today, where gay characters are popping up in a lot of different areas, and it's been done. It was very revolutionary. So he will be missed, and thank you both for highlighting his contribution, and so we don't forget him and what he did. I want to switch gears here, take us now to the lovely state of Oklahoma, and welcome Troy to our show. Welcome tonight, Troy.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. So Troy, can you give me an overview of what is the LGBT state of affairs in the state of Oklahoma?
Well, it depends on how you want to look at it. So over the the good news is, since our organization was founded in 2009, there's not been a single piece of anti-LGBT legislation that's been passed. This year, we're up against a deadline that might change that fact. So, it's Senate Bill 1140, which is an Oklahoma bill that would allow religious organizations to discriminate against same-sex couples, or interfaith couples, or single mothers, or single fathers, or anybody they actually religiously disagreed with, from adopting children. It's a violation of the Establishment Clause. It's a violation of equal protection. It's an absolutely, from what our lawyers say, it's an egregious violation of the Constitution of the United States of America and the Constitution of Oklahoma. So that's what we're up against right now.
I think that, sorry about that, I actually had a technical problem. I had my mute on, so let's start again. Troy, you and I first encountered each other when you were at Garden State Equality, and you left there and you came back to Oklahoma. So you and I have actually known each other for a while. Let's talk about the dynamics of being a red state versus obviously Jersey, which is more of a blue state, in terms of public perception, and you know, especially as you're literally doing combat, okay, with Oklahoma City versus Trenton, and your approach to that, because there is a different dynamic at play here, particularly with the influences of the religious right.
There absolutely is. And when I was in New Jersey, we were, and I'll remind everybody that Governor Christie, when I was in New Jersey, actually was the second governor in the United States, a Republican governor, that signed a ban on conversion therapy. We were the second state in the country that banned conversion therapy, and the first, I believe, the first that actually put a ban in effect. Which was unprecedented at the time, but it was a different world. What we're dealing with right now is a governor that is in her last few months of office, and we have a pretty close relationship with Governor Fallon. So we're hopeful that the legislation that we're considering passing, that they're considering passing, is going to be defeated by a gubernatorial veto. We're still trying to defeat it at the committee level and at the legislative level, but I think our best bet is to have Governor Fallon actually veto it. And I personally and my organization have had a lot of success at getting governors to veto or these kind of bills.
Hi, Troy, it's Karen Oakham. Could you explain how this came to be? I mean, I'm kind of surprised that Oklahoma didn't jump on the bandwagon after Prop 8, you know, which was our ban on marriage equality, same-sex marriage. I mean, we had marriage equality, and then it was taken away from us, and the National Organization for Marriage and a bunch of other people tried to export that. They exported it to Maine and were successful, and they were eventually stopped. I know you were in New Jersey, so you probably remember all that play on the East Coast as well. But that was the time when, as I remember, when a lot of the religious right started, you know, fermenting their religious liberties discussions. So how did it take like 10 years in Oklahoma, of all places, for this bill to come up? I mean, what happened?
It's a good question. And just for background on myself, I was actually in Maine in 2009 when we were fighting that legislation. So I was on that campaign. And it was one of the most heartbreaking I've ever dealt with, because we came within 3 percentage points in Maine of actually being the first state to pass it at the ballot. So it's been hard. But the reason it's happened here in Oklahoma is because we've been very effective at stopping legislators from putting these bills forward. They actually have no real will to do it. The reason this one is going forward is because they're selling it as a bill that will allow more adoption agencies to come into the state of Oklahoma. What they don't understand is that the numbers don't weigh out in the way that they think they do. There's no shortage of agencies in Oklahoma or any other state trying to do adoptions. There's a shortage of families. There's a shortage of parents trying to adopt kids. So they're doing absolutely the opposite of what they think. There's also the fact that, and I'll be real honest, we've been meeting with attorneys, and we're meeting with the governor, we're meeting with the governor's family, and we're meeting with legislators. But at the end of the day, we've already started working with attorneys. This is a blatant violation of the Establishment Clause, which means that there is a violation of the fact that there's government agency giving money to a religious agency. There's also a blatant violation of equal protection, meaning that we're being discriminated against as a community. And our attorneys believe we've got a slam dunk case. But what nobody understands is we've got a slam dunk case anyway. This is already happening. It's not just happening in Oklahoma. It's happening across the country. Catholic charities and Baptist organizations and many other organizations are already discriminating. But our community has not taken this fight up because we want as many kids as possible to be adopted. And it's not a fight that we want to undertake. But if they're going to blatantly codify into law that organizations can discriminate against LGBTQ couples or LGBTQ individuals or interfaith individuals or single individuals, we're going to fight it. We're going to fight it in court, and we're going to win. And it's an ill-advised situation that they're taking up. So while we think we can beat this thing at committee next week and possibly in the full Oklahoma House of Representatives, and we believe that if it gets that far, the governor will veto it. If none of this happens, if this thing actually becomes law, we know that we'll beat it in court. And what they need to understand is that if we beat it in court, and the Oklahoma State Constitution is very clear on this, unlike Michigan or Mississippi, where this is already being litigated, the Oklahoma State Constitution has actually got it's more clear on what is a violation. We will be the first state to beat this, and they're going to put themselves in a world of hurt if they think this is something they can replicate throughout the country.
Well, listen, let me follow up on that, because you raised Mississippi, and that was something I was going to ask you about. I remember when folks here started warning that Prop 8 was a possibility, nobody believed it. Nobody in our community believed it, because nobody believed that people would be that cruel. You probably experienced the same thing in Maine. So it was very, very difficult to raise awareness and raise money for the possible, potential, expected initiative fight or to fight in court, just as you were just saying. So how are you – what kind of education campaign are you launching, and are you starting to raise money, you know, just in case? I mean, you do have to pay those lawyers. And even if there is a veto, if there's pressure from the Koch brothers or the RNC or the Trump folks on the Republicans or whomever in the state legislature, they may just override that veto. So nothing is assured until it's assured, until it's done. So what are you – I'm assuming you're starting some sort of a campaign.
Yes, we already have. And there's zero chance of a veto override the state of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Oklahoma, unlike Mississippi and unlike other states that have passed Michigan and other states – people have figured out this is happening. They figured out that this is the next level of discrimination. This is the bias that's coming forward. We've got the State Chamber of the State of Oklahoma, the chambers of Oklahoma City and Norman and Tulsa and other places. We've got Apple and Google and Amazon and AT&T and Microsoft talking to state legislators. I mean, this is not... if they do this, it's a horrible – if anybody's been following what's happening in the state of Oklahoma, we've got 30, 40, and 50,000 teachers revolting. I mean,
yes,
it's an insurgency in the state capitol and on the steps of the state house.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
this is not
something
they want to deal with. I mean, we've got business leaders throughout the state saying this is awful. So it's bizarre that they're taking this up next week, and we think that we can beat it. We think that the fact that – I mean, and I'll tell you this on the air right now, and we haven't announced this yet, but but Chad Griffin, the head of HRC, will be here next week.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is we're talking about a national level situation where people are coming to our aid, and people are coming to talk about this, and national organizations, national corporations are talking about how this, we've got to stop this right here. Because if it happens in Oklahoma, I mean, we always call ourselves a canary in a coal mine, and we are. If it happens here, it will happen other places. It's happened in other states already, seven of them, and it shouldn't have. But if it goes through this state legislature, we're looking at a watershed opening. And while we know we can beat it in court, we know that it's completely unconstitutional, it's an embarrassment for the state of Oklahoma. And it's honestly an embarrassment for the nation if this thing passes, because we're talking about kids. We're talking about youth in the state of Oklahoma and across the country that don't have homes. There are 14,000 young people that don't have homes in Oklahoma, and we're talking about limiting the number of families that can adopt them. I mean, it's absurd. The same-sex couples and gay parents are the highest number. Let's put all of it aside and say that they can't have kids on most occasions unless they're doing extraordinary circumstances. So they're the ones adopting. They're the ones fostering at higher levels than anybody else. And to exclude them from this process is absolutely obscene, because we're talking about thousands of families that will be taking on kids. We're talking about DHS in Oklahoma says that LGBTQ couples are the folks that they're going after at the highest levels, because
mm-hmm.
they're the ones adopting.
Mm-hmm.
And to exclude those folks from the process, we're not just talking about discrimination. We're talking about hurting kids. We're talking about keeping kids out of loving and affirming families. And that's just gross.
Yeah, I agree with you. Here in Los Angeles, our foster groups Raise a Child USA is working very closely with the LA County Family and Children Agency, and they go after LGBT parents because, frankly, they adopt and foster kids who are disabled,
yep.
who are older, the kids that nobody else wants. And so,
yeah.
That's a whole other level that people have forgotten about.
It is. I mean, one of my staff members, she and her partner have adopted an 11-year-old who had severe developmental deficiencies. They love him. They have nurtured him. They have turned him into, just an amazing kid over the last few years. And this is not something that happens very often. And we see this over and over and over again. It is queer couples, and it is queer parents that are adopting these kids that are the most desperate for a family, that are the most desperate for a home.
Mm-hmm.
And to discriminate against those folks, to discriminate against the very people that are taking in the most vulnerable in our society, I say it again, it's just gross. It's disgusting.
Troy, you're doing nothing but punishing kids. Yeah, I can relate a lot to what you're saying, because I am a gay dad and foster parent, and have written about that. And so you're talking about actually me if I was living in Oklahoma. I've got a couple questions for you. You answered one already in terms of the need, because they're one of the things that has kept a lot of this from having cropped up prior to even marriage equality, where many states allowed gay adoptions where they didn't allow same-sex marriage for years, was because the need was so great. And you've already
right.
characterized the need as being fairly great in Oklahoma. What, in your perception, worst-case doomsday scenario that this passed, how many of the agencies out there do you think would take on being discriminatory
in the market. Do you think this would become a predominant thing, or is this more show of the saber rattling on the right?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a legitimate question. And what I'm going to tell you is my job is not to perceive the best case scenario. My job is to tell you what can happen with the legalities of this law. And if this were to pass, every single private agency outside of DHS in the state of Oklahoma could potentially say that they were going to deny access to adoption to same-sex couples, to interfaith couples, to single parents, to anybody that they didn't like. I mean, it's not, we're not just talking about a situation where it's their religious freedom. We're talking about it's a right of conscience. I mean, we're talking about giving state dollars, federal dollars to folks that could discriminate. And I mean, I can't extrapolate how many of these agencies are actually going to do this. My hope is that none of them would, because they understand they're doing the work. I mean, they're doing yeoman's work. I mean, they're adopting kids. And I can't imagine anybody in good faith saying that they would deny a home to a child. But in all honesty, I think they will. Some of them will. And they all
can.
Yeah,
absolutely. Some will. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I can't actually answer your question except to say that this law is disgusting, and it would allow any of them outside of the Department of Human Services to actually discriminate.
Well, let's talk about that for just a second, Troy, because in some of the conversations that you and I have had, obviously we have focused in on members of the Christian right there in Oklahoma, including Stephen Black and the gentleman at the university that you and I talked about, who have led the campaign in this regard. And what concerns me, and I guess this is what I'd have to ask you, we have a governor sitting in Oklahoma that compared, you know, teachers to high schoolers with their first car trying to trade up. And I'm like, okay, well, that works out well.
Yep.
With the noise that the Christian right is making, how is that going to affect as we go into this legislative process?
Well, I mean, first off, I'm going to tell you that the governor that you just mentioned, and yes, she made a huge mistake with that comment. And she has made some huge mistakes in her career, but she is actually we speak on a regular basis. She's a good person. And we believe wholeheartedly that if this passes, we've got a 70% chance that she'll veto it. The legislation is that ugly. Oklahoma has got a reputation for being 49th out of 50 in ugly legislation. But once again, since Freedom Oklahoma was founded 9 years ago, we have not one of these bills has passed. And the only time one got through the legislature, Governor Fallon vetoed it. So we're not what other states are. And as much as people would like to portray us as the bottom of the bottom, Oklahoma is not the most anti-LGBT state in the union by any means. And I think that this bill is being used right now as a propaganda piece to the right to get some votes on a budget. I mean, we've got 40,000 teachers a day standing outside of our Capitol. And leadership in the House and the Senate are trying to get them to pass revenue. And they're trading anything they can. So some right-wing legislators, they're trading this for. We believe that we can stop it in the committee. We believe we can stop it in the House. But we're pretty sure we can stop it with the governor.
So, okay, let me do a quick follow-up then. You're telling me that Governor Fallon more or less probably would not acquiesce to demands from the state legislature to sign this particular piece of legislation because it would be flawed. But let me ask you this. would the governor be inclined to sign something that wasn't quite as onerous and restrictive if the legislative body came back with a lighter version of it?
I don't know what the wider version could be. We've got amendments that, I mean, we at the moment with the committee hearing we've got coming up in on next Wednesday, we've got at the moment we got 32 amendments that have been added by friendly
mm-hmm.
legislators. I don't know which one of those amendments could actually make this more appealing. The only one I could think of is the one that strips state and federal funding from it, which, in all honesty, is not something we would absolutely support, but it would actually put us in a better de jure place than we are de facto right now. Because what's happening right now is that discrimination is happening. And it is already a violation of equal protection and the Establishment Clause, but we're not suing on it because guess what? We want kids to get adopted, and we don't want to make this an issue. And if Catholic charities are being bigots, it's not fine, but we can overlook it. But if they're going to codify it into law, we're going to fight them. So if the state of Oklahoma wants to pass a law that says that they're not going to give any state or federal funding to Catholic charities or any Baptist organization or any Methodist or any of these organizations that are discriminating,
mm-hmm.
we're going to fight it to tooth and nail. And we're going to sue. I mean, we have already hired the best law firm in the state of Oklahoma. We've got a former U.S. attorney that's writing a letter to every single legislator that's thinking about passing this, saying it's egregiously unconstitutional. But we have not sued on this yet, nor have any other state. Nobody is suing on this, and this is what they're assuming is that we're going to sue on it. We will take them to court, and we will win if they pass this. But what we're telling all of them is the status quo is whatever it is, as long as they don't try to codify this into law. Because it's gross that they're doing it, but it's disgusting that they try to codify into law. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Troy, I wanted to ask you, we were talking at the beginning of this whole conversation about a little bit about so-called conversion therapy or reparative
yes.
therapy. And as you may know, North American, whatever the hell is, reparative therapy for homosexuals, and Dr. Nicolosi and all that stuff. I mean, Nicolosi's office was literally like right over the hill from where I live. I mean, it's the whole thing is creepy. But I'm wondering if in this whole part, this is a little different from the discussion about your bill here, but you are so knowledgeable about conversion therapy, having, gone through this with New Jersey, and we're having a second conversion therapy bill go through the state legislature here in California now, and looking at it as junk science and fraud. But I'm wondering where you are if part of the problem is that people, voters, the majority of Oklahoma residents, really think that LGBT people are abnormal and can be cured. I mean, I'm wondering if part of the resistance to having gay people adopt is that they're abnormal, that they're only trying to recruit kids and make them homosexual themselves. And what we need actually as a parallel to this no adoption thing is a reparative therapy bill that in some way, shape, or form will not allow any state or federal funding to go to any LGBT group until they're cured.
Now, I get where you're going with that. And this is one of the times that when I say that Oklahoma is misunderstood.
Okay.
There's something we call the Oklahoma Standard. And it is about standing up for others. It's about, in times of crisis, we stand with each other. And it's about absolute love. And there is zero chance that in fact, there's zero chance because we already did this 2 years ago. The only state in the union that has ever attempted to pass a pro-conversion therapy law
mm-hmm.
was Oklahoma. It went down in flames.
Mm-hmm.
And it went down in committee. And it went down in an unprecedented vote with Republicans siding with us. It doesn't – no. People get how damaging it is. People get how horrible it is. And we are not ready yet to put a ban on conversion therapy on the ballot or before the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
We're not far off. And we will not be the last state to do it. We will be in the top 25.
Mm-hmm.
Oklahomans
well,
are not.
It's good to know that you say that Oklahoma is misunderstood in that way, and that most people are like loving people. But I mean, forgive me for this, but I'll remind you that you said the same thing about Maine, and that Maine would not deny its, you know, gay couples marriage, loving gay couples to get married. I mean,
I didn't say that.
I'm sorry. I meant you. You said you were part of the Maine campaign.
And this is a good point. During the Maine campaign, we were calling it, at the time, we considered what we were doing moving the ball forward. We didn't think we could win. We knew what we were doing. We knew that we were advancing a good cause that would happen after us. I mean, we didn't mistake good intentions for positive results. We knew that we were doing good work that would have good results in the future. And it's the same thing we've been doing in Oklahoma for a very long time. We've been messaging. We've been working with the media. We've been working with the public. We've got thousands of volunteers. And we are working our – I don't know what the level of this radio program is, but we're going our asses off to make sure that people understand that during this teacher strike, we're feeding 2,000 teachers a day. There's 40,000 down there sometimes, but we as an organization are feeding 2,000 a day because we are part of this community. We're making sure that they see us as part of this community. And it's really hard to vote against, to be against somebody that's part of a community. So, yes, we failed at Maine, but we knew we were failing. And we might fail tomorrow. We might fail next week in Oklahoma, but we know we're failing. But we know we're moving the ball forward.
Troy, kind of going on the reparative therapy issue, because I was very involved in all the things that happened here in California as that legislation broke ground and went through. And I wrote about a lot of the conversion reparative therapy practices that were going on here. Can you give an overview of what that, quote-unquote, industry looks like in Oklahoma? What is the, a lot of them are kind of this church-based, hold your hands and pray, the gay away type things. Others are more nefarious with actually trying to do some bizarre practices, and then the NARTH stuff. What does it look like in Oklahoma? What are the current practices that are quote unquote available?
Well, there's many available, but what I think that you know and what I know is that since Exodus International went away, was it 2013? Am I correct?
don't remember, but somewhere around there.
Yeah, I believe it was probably right around there. I think, yeah, as a matter of fact, when I talked to Alan Chambers, who was the last executive director of Exodus, when this was like 6 months ago when we talked about it, I think that's about right, Troy.
Yeah, I think it was 2013. That's when I was running the marriage campaign in New Jersey. I believe that's when they went away. What happened is Stephen Black, who is the head of First Home Ministries here in Oklahoma City, took up the mantle. So, ironically, what we've not talked about is none of you know what my history is with conversion therapy. My first boyfriend in high school committed suicide because of conversion therapy when I was 15. And it has been a lifelong mission of mine. So what happened in New Jersey was not ironic. It was not serendipitous. It was that it's been a lifelong situation of mine that I think this needs to go away. What is difficult for me right now is that after passing the second ban in the country, it was the first one to go into effect. I'm now dealing with the biggest conversion therapy organization, the biggest conversion therapist in the country, that is housed about 4 miles from my office. They don't back down. They think they have taken up the mantle of Exodus International, and it's based right here in Oklahoma City. So it's a real fight. And what I fought in New Jersey was what we banned in New Jersey was licensed practitioners harming minors. Well, that's not what we're fighting here. What we're fighting here is consumer fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're fighting here is people that are claiming that they're going to help somebody, quote unquote, but they know they can't help. And what we're fighting here is the worst situation of conversion therapy mispractice in the country. And it's an ongoing fight. And I deal with members of my own community wanting to go after them. And me being who I am and having done this for so long and understanding what we have to, how we have to fight it and how we can't go after churches in the state of Oklahoma or Arkansas or Texas or Kansas. I mean, we have to fight it on a very factual level, and it's hard, and we're doing that.
Well, I think also part of it, Troy, is the optics. I mean, you and I have discussed the fact that, especially in Oklahoma, the optics of it would not look good when you look at the State House and they have people sitting there like they did at one point with Sally Kern, that, you know, some of these lawmakers are just so rabidly supportive of the so-called, you know, and they put it under the umbrella of religious freedom. You know, in terms of doing that, and it simply would be bad optics. And I think that the other part of it is that the community may or may not understand, you know, that there's a very methodical set way of doing this in order to, you know, achieve, I think, the end result, which is obviously some way of, you know, making it go away. And, of course, in Oklahoma, you guys aren't able to touch them because it is not under Oklahoma law. It just simply doesn't fall, you know, under therapeutic practices and licensing and things like that. So it's kind of a different area. And so it really is politics.
It really is politics. And I mean, in a way it does. It does operate under those levels. And we're trying to reach out to those agencies. But what you and I talked about when you initially invited me on this program is the people that were talking to you have reached out to me this week under duress because they realized exactly how bad it could get. I mean, it is, and to explain that, there are really well-meaning folks that are attempting to do really well-meaning things. But sometimes there is a backlash against that in red states or in uber-religious states that is not a good backlash. And we have to take care of that as a statewide LGBTQ rights organization. And that has happened in this situation. So we have taken this from being a protest against the church to being a town hall meeting in a church, in an affirming church that talks about how the things that they're talking about are not appropriate.
Troy, may I draw your attention to what's happening here in California? Because I think it might help you. Our old friends, Frank Schubert, who was pushing Prop 8, he's working with a group called the Capital Resources Institute, and they are freaking out about our new anti-conversion therapy bill. If you go to losangelesblade.com and look up my story, it's called Assembly Committee Passes Bill Banning Conversion Therapy for Adults. In it, you'll see I talk about the religious rights theme, their presentation, bill attacking pastors and counselors before committee, and that the bigger picture is that California is about to outlaw speech. And they have on board our other old friends, the Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF.
Oh, they're my biggest opponent at the moment. Yeah,
right, exactly. But I have a link to ADF's seven-page memo, as well as a matter of fact, I link to what's happening in your there's a Christian Newswire story about what's happening in your territory. But it also explains what our LGBT legislative caucus is doing in response. So the language is there, and you see both sides of it for you maybe to be able to, to get some points from. It might be a useful tool for you.
Karen, I'm going to have to jump in.
Are we about to run out of time?
Actually, I've got
to
jump in, guys. We are literally out of time. So, great reference. Thanks, Karen, for that. And, Troy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Hope we covered all the issues.
By the way, I appreciate all of you. Thank you so much for highlighting Oklahoma.
And, Troy, really, quick question. How do people get in contact with you and help on this issue?
FreedomOklahoma.org. You can log on. You can send messages to legislators. You can donate. You can do whatever you want, but just FreedomOklahoma.org.
Perfect. Great. And so, folks, get involved. Get involved in every state that this is coming up. Your voice is important, even if you're from the outside. Again, Troy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Very informative, and we're on board. We have your back, and we will continue the fight with you from outside Oklahoma, but wish you the best inside. For Brody Levesque and Karen Oakham, thank you for listening. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific time. You can hear that live stream, www.ksto.com. And we will be back next week here with another fantastic Rated LGBT show. So stay tuned.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.